have our author, Javier Pescador, whom I'll introduce in a moment. We have Ben Smith, and also Icapo Cipande, and myself, Peter Aleggi. It's a genuine pleasure to welcome Juan Javier Pescador to the Football Scholars Forum, our inaugural meeting of the 2012-2013 season. Just a couple of words about Javier. He's professor of history here at Michigan State, got his PhD from the University of Michigan in 1998, and we've forgiven him for that. He teaches history of Mexicans in the United States, American sports history, and a very popular college sports history course. His research focuses on Mexican cultures in the U.S., as we saw in the paper, with a focus on sports, religion, leisure, photography, and media. He also works on American sports culture in the era of globalization. So, as is customary, our author will speak for just a few minutes, maybe contextualize the paper, give us a couple of insights, and then we will open the field for discussion. We'll do one question each at the beginning so we can keep the flow going, and we'll start in East Lansing and then move to our Skype group. If you want to use the chat function on Skype to sort of do a virtual hand raising to ask your questions, that might work well. And please, if you're not speaking, if you could mute your mic so that we don't pick up your ambience sound in the process. Okay, so without further ado, let's turn it over to Javier.
Well, thank you, Peter. Welcome, everybody, to this first reunion of the Football Scholars Forum. As Peter was saying, I am working right now on a history of Mexican sports communities in the United States. You can call them Mexican fans or Mexican athletic sports associations in the United States, or Mexican sports fandom in the United States. I've been working on this project for a while, and it starts pretty much in the 1920s with the formation of soccer associations, soccer teams, and then soccer leagues by people of Mexican descent in the U.S. as they arrive or as they settle in this country at the beginning of the 20th century. So what I have is basically a structure in which I describe or analyze the connections between these sports associations, sports teams, sports communities, and their social and economic realities. And what I'm presenting today would be like the last chapter in which I analyze the multidimensional connections between globalization and the Mexican sports communities. And I follow the history of performances by the Mexican national team in the United States from 1970 to the present year. Now, to my surprise, I discovered that in the 1980s, the Mexican national team started to play in the U.S. just as frequently as in Mexico. And that in the 1980s, the games played by the Mexican national team in the United States outnumbered the games played in Mexico. And now the ratio is like, for every game played in Mexico by the Mexican national team, you have at least two games played in the United States. So I analyze that process of transnational performances, and I look at the way in which globalization is producing new ways of sports spectatorship in the current present times. That is how nationals or Mexican nationals or people of Mexican descent respond to the Mexican national team in the United States. What difference do I see between these manifestations and what's going on in Mexico or in other places? And to what extent these processes of globalization are not only generating global audiences, but also providing a social space in which these global audiences are also manifesting or expressing or developing their own ways, their own identity as sports fans, now based on a different territory. So this paper basically analyzes or follows the Mexican national team in the United States and how people respond to that. And it produces, or it certainly underlines the influence of media, transnational media, and U.S. Spanish media in the process, right? In the 1980s, the Spanish network Univision decided to follow soccer matches from the Mexican League and then decided to broadcast the Mexican World Cup 1986. And that is going to be a pivotal moment in the history of these audiences or these fans as spectators in the soccer arena, right? Now, what I analyze is not only the participation of these fans in the stadium, but also how they act or behave or express their athletic affiliations in their own community. So I have an analysis of the soccer associations, the soccer leagues by people of Mexican descent from 1970 to the present times. And I have a detailed narrative of how these soccer associations have become, by far, the largest voluntary associations by people of Mexican descent in the United States. So they not only act, or people not only go to the stadium, you know, to participate as fans, but they also have, as members of the sports community, they have a number of different activities that include athletic participation on leagues and teams that they are created on their own, and also socio-political participation in which they activate these soccer networks for different purposes, right? One of the examples that I have analyzed throughout the decade, throughout the 1970s and 80s, is the club Tajimaroa in Chicago, that it is a translocal, transnational soccer club that has a very decisive and important influence, not only in Chicago, but also in the place of origin or the ancestral home of these communities in Tajimaroa and Michoacán. These people get together, they send money back to their place of origin. They also participate in civic works, the place of origin, and they organize different social and then political activities using this soccer network. So I'm trying to analyze the extent to which these sporting societies have also are also generating other type of civic participation that is no longer confined to the athletic achievements in the amateur or professional field. And what I discovered in regards to this paper is that Mexican fans or fans of Mexican origin in the United States have already generated a kind of separate a social identity as sports fans in the U.S. by the use of masks, right? They use masks that they have borrowed from the wrestling matches in Mexico that were very popular in the 1950s and 60s, and especially from the image of El Santo. El Santo is going to be a professional wrestler that becomes a film star in Mexico in the 1940s, in the late 1950s and 60s, and El Santo is going to provide sort of the archetype hero framework that Mexican fans are going to use to portray themselves in the United States. So one of my findings is that Mexican fans in the United States are fully aware of the excessive influence of media in the broadcasting of the games. They are fully aware of that in these soccer events, you go not only to see the event, but also to be seen. And they have started to use this mask to portray the Mexican experience in a heroic, in the United States, in a heroic narrative, in heroic terms, right? That is, they are there to not only to watch the game, but also to be seen as the heroes in the Mexican history in the United States. They are the wrestlers that use their physical attributes to struggle against, you know, whatever comes as or is seen as adversity for the Mexican experience in the United States. So I discovered this type of connection between the masked fans and the U.S. or the American experience by Mexican fans. And I also analyzed the ways in which this process of globalization, instead of generating a standardized way to look at games, is producing exactly the opposite. Like, fans are using this excessive presence or omnipresence of cameras and iPhones and other devices to portray, to generate images that are in connection to other images that come from media about the Mexican experience in the United States. That is, they are using these sports events to participate in a dialogue to create a visual sort of a dissonance in which they refute the images that are portrayed, that portray Mexicans in the United States as sidekicks or gardeners or babysitters or illegal workers or that type of situation. So I sort of identify that type of connection in which there is a dialogue, a visual dialogue in which the fans showcase themselves in a very different light by using what Rooney Arledge and the Monday Night Football, you know, crowd discovered in the 1960s, right? That is, that people go to sports events not only to see the athletic competition, but also to participate in the event, to be a protagonist in the event. They use that to showcase themselves. And in this case, you know, it's a clear example of how the Mexican fans are sort of casting themselves in a different light by attending soccer games with the Mexican national team in or with the disguise of a wrestler mask.
Folks in East Lansing will take the first stab. One question each before we go to our Skype members. Can we go to the Mexicanist Ben Smith here, if you would like to ask the first question?
Right. Well, first of all, I really enjoyed this piece, and I just want to say, well, I thought there were kind of two profound ironies in this. One is the wrestling, mass wrestling brought over by, what, a U.S. guy, I think from Chicago, in the 1930s. So they're using masks, which were originated in the U.S. in order to demonstrate against now U.S. hegemony. And also I thought Octavio Paz in Labyrinth of Solitude, who believes that the Chicano, you know, wears a particularly profound, I mean, all Mexicans wear a mask, but in some ways the Chicano will wear, you know, a mask more of the time than your kind of average Mexican. And this is, you know, so that kind of interested me. What also interested me is, and you clearly know quite a lot also about the Mexican football team in Mexico, but why? Clearly there's the draw of having a large Chicano community that's obsessive about Mexican football. But why has Mexico itself not developed that kind of, you know, really enthusiastic fan base? To a certain extent, it has, but I do know that, you know, when it won the gold in the Olympics, yes, there were some celebrations, but not, as far as I can make out from the newspapers, not like there were in the US. And there didn't seem to be that kind of enthusiasm. So where has that kind of, you know, enthusiasm that was, I think, during the kind of 80s and 90s, where has that gone?
So starting with the second question, why Mexico itself has not tried to develop that fan base. What I detected in my research, in my paper, is that, you know, the Mexican national team has a very, very ironic history, right? That is, between 1923 and 1970, nobody wants to play against the Mexican national team, right? Because there is no there is nothing to win, right? Mexican national team has no reputation, right? And has no status, right? So defeating the Mexican national team brings pretty much nothing to, you know, powerhouses in the history of soccer. So what the Mexican authorities in the 1970s discovered is that if they feature the Mexican national team in the United States playing against the United States or other teams from the area, that is going to provide an edge, you know, a local advantage to the Mexican national team, and yet, and also a fan base that is going to see the Mexican national team in a positive light, because the Mexican national team is going to win for, you know, for the most part, right? Now, if you take that back to Mexico, where they have to have, like, the FIFA qualifiers, for instance, they have to be in the national territory, right, for the most part. So in Mexico, if you take back, to the Mexican local arena, the Mexican audiences are used to see Mexico struggling, right? And they are used to see Mexico not winning, and they are used to criticize the Mexican national team a lot, right? Because there's, like, the media, the sports media in Mexico basically made a tradition of criticizing the Mexican national team, right? It's like sports media in Chicago, right? They know that the Chicago Cubs are not going to win this year, maybe not the next year, maybe not the following year. So in order to have readers for sports, you know, writing, they criticize the team, and they look for the negative aspects of it. And that's how the Mexican press positions itself versus, or towards the Mexican team, right? So in Mexico, it's not that easy, right? But in the United States, if you have the Mexican national team playing against the United States from the 1970s, you know, chances are they are going to win, right? They are going to overpower the United States. Now, in the world competitions, everybody wants to play Mexico, right? And that's why Mexico has been in so many opening games in World Cups. It was in South Africa, it was in Uruguay, it was in Brazil, because Mexico is perceived as a weak team, right? So in other words, the brand, we're talking here about two brands, a brand for the Mexican national team in Mexico and a brand for the Mexican national team in the United States, right? And what you were saying about the use of mask in wrestling that was generated in the U.S., yeah, it's absolutely correct, right? It starts in the United States, but in Mexico, the process of urbanization, you have this very interesting historical development by which the boxing entrepreneurs discovered that they can use the same arena, the same locale for wrestling, right? In boxing, in Mexico, one of the most popular sports throughout the 20th century. And it's actually one of the sports where Mexicans have an international reputation, right? Mexican boxing, they're known since the 1930s. So the boxing entrepreneurs discovered that wrestling is a complement to boxing, and they're going to import, like, you know, step by step, the wrestling industry from the United States, including the masks. And I'm saying this because by the late 1930s, 1940s, 1950s, wrestling has already been creolized by Mexican lower classes. Wrestling has already been adopted and embraced by the Mexican middle class. Then you have, in the late 1950s and 60s, the example, right? But this is presented as a local hero, even though, you know, wrestling, the whole sport, it's a complete importation from the United States.
I have any questions, but I enjoyed the Mexico, and I appreciate especially the dialogue the Mexican soccer fans in the U.S. have with the back of kind of showing that they are thriving and positive, the culture that is making positive contributions to the U.S.
Well, I think that's a really fun, because I think we're in the process of seeing
very similar developments in Europe when you have these communities from outside Europe over establishing themselves. And I think we're going to see this type of developments also in Asia, right? And in other places where you have significant patterns of immigration and professionalization and importation of athletes on regular terms from different locations in the planet. Like, I think this is a process in which sporting communities are becoming global communities in terms of considering national territory no longer a condition to cheer or to follow a particular brand. Right? And what I see in the paper is that the Mexican national team has become a brand. I mean, it doesn't have a territory. It's a deterritorialized or transterritorialized or re-territorialized brand. You can be a fan of the Mexican national team anywhere because of the process of globalization. Just in the same way in which you have fans for the Barcelona football club or Manchester United or Juve, what have you, worldwide. Right? Because they are no longer, confined to a particular territory. They are on TV, that's where they are, on TV. When I was giving a similar talk at the St. John's University, we went to share a meal with the students, and one of the students had lived in Spain. I lived in Spain for 2 years, and I remember, I lived in the Basque Country, where the Real Sociedad and the Athletic, they are the Bible, right? And I asked one of the students, so who were you cheering for in soccer in Spain? And she said, the Real Madrid and the Barcelona. And I was like, when I was in Spain in the 1990s, nobody would say that, nobody. But now we have people that follow the Real Madrid and the Barcelona as they follow, they buy, Nike and Adidas shoes, right? They're brands. They are not seen as opposite or exclusive or anything like that, right?
I'll be quick so that we can bring in our Skype colleagues. I also enjoyed the paper. I particularly like the way you used history to not only contextualize, but also explain what's happening in contemporary times in terms of the experiences of Mexican fans of El Tri in the United States. What I really liked the most, and I really appreciated, was the fact that you treated fans as historical actors with agency, and not as simply passive recipients of these global forces, like media or the influence of mega corporations. So I really liked that these fans are not, as you put it, are far from being passive, and they're not just reacting to these external pressures and demands and expectations. I think you humanized this history quite nicely. I also really like the section on the leagues, the Mexican leagues in the United States, in Chicago and Detroit. For those of you who read the other chapter that was available that Javier wrote, there's even more information about those leagues. But I also sensed a little bit of tension in this paper between this domestic soccer scene in the U.S. among Mexican communities and this global brandification or branding of El Tri. I think maybe those sections could be integrated a little more closely. In other words, how is it that CLASA and the Detroit League, for example, are actually shaping the way in which El Tri is being embraced and those symbols appropriated and performed? I'm curious about that. And I would also just ask one question for you to respond to. The anthropologist Sergio Varela, who has joined us at the FSF previously, he's written about the El Tri fans in South Africa at the World Cup in 2010, and he has a much more critical take on the fans. He seems to disagree with your point that this is a subversion, this is almost a kind of cultural resistance that Mexican fans are performing, if you want to take a Gramscian view. He says in his paper that's coming out in a book that Chris Boltzmann and I have done on Africa's World Cup, he says that to be Mexican at the 2010 World Cup meant to practice one of the aspects of commercial impulse, the nationalist chauvinistic one, which is essentially a discourse that appeals to certain traditions, symbols, myths, rituals, and choreographies invented by and for the exaltation of modernity itself. He then goes on and says, these are closet Mexicans, to use the expression of Carlos Monsiváis.
They represented Mexican men and women who expressed their nationalistic impulses under the guidance of big business and triggered by copious amounts of alcohol during glamorous and expensive events. He says this is a banal and superficial sense of nationhood, best captured by the ever-present chant, Mexico, Mexico, ra, ra, ra. How do you respond to that kind of a take?
I mean, in my opinion, there is a point. There is a very important conditioning factor that comes from the economic power to participate in these events, right? And I describe in the paper, you know, how much money it takes to see or to be a Chicolor fan in the United States. But precisely because of that, I emphasize that fans are very aware of that type of a social barrier, and that they use that social barrier to display themselves as a successful economic story in the United States, because not everybody can afford to cheer off for Mexico in the United States, because you have to pay almost NFL prices for the tickets, right? They use that barrier, you know, to say, look at me. You know, I'm Mexican and I made it, and I have money, you know, to be in front of your TV, right? I am like wealthy enough or successful enough economically to be in front of your TV. And I think there is a process of tension between these commercial forces and the agency, the ideals and the aspirations of the fans. I was teaching in China this summer. I went to watch a game between Shanghai and Beijing, right? Shanghai has a lot of South American players, and I was very surprised, very impressed by the way in which FIFA standards apply anywhere in the world. It's like the players entrance into the field, you know, the national anthems, you know, the FIFA song, all that, how everything is so standardized. But at the same time, I was also very surprised to see how Chinese football fans behave in such a different way from anybody else, right? And I've been to soccer stadiums in many places, and you discover that when you go to enough soccer games, that each aficion, each group of soccer fans behave different, and they have different agendas, and they don't go there just to feel the stain. They go there to protagonize and to display their own stories within the boundaries of commercialism, but they go there, you know, to show themselves, and this is why, you know, I think the studies on the history of sports and media are so important, and what ABC did, you know, in the United States is so important, because they discovered that fans want to be seen as members of the sports event, that fans, you know, showcase themselves in very different lights, right? And we've seen that process in fans in the NFL, Major League Baseball, and in other venues in which you would expect, you know, standardized forms of fan behavior, right? But that is not what you find. I mean, there is no way you can compare, you know, the Raider Nation to the Red Sox Nation, right? These two fans that are middle class and that are suburban, but they don't behave in the same way. So what I would say is that the soccer stadium is not different than any other social space. And therefore, it has external forces that are trying to shape human behavior, right? In this case, the fans' behavior, but also you have to recognize the agency of the fans in responding, reacting, and having their own agenda, their own identity to be displayed at that particular social space. I don't think soccer stadiums are different than any other, you know, social spaces in that regard.
Okay, let's open it up to everyone else. Who'd like to go first?
If I could just comment real quick, Peter, Sean Jacobs is trying to get into the call. You should be able to ask him, or you should be able to add him without restarting the call. There should be like a little plus button somewhere in the call menu. if you're looking at the current reopen call.
Sean, are you in?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, brilliant.
Awesome. Cool. I think Corey or maybe somebody else had a question, so they can go ahead.
Yeah, I have a quick question. Can you all hear me?
Yeah, who is this? Please identify yourself.
Okay, this is Corey out in Utah.
Okay, great. Thank you.
I wonder if you've done any research on the youth level of soccer. I'm seeing, here where I work with my kids in a youth soccer league, a transformation of what would be considered a typical sort of middle class white club, where they've mixed with there are Mexican leagues here, and then there are kind of white middle class leagues for kids. But they're starting to come together, and it's causing a change in the way those kind of traditional white middle class clubs have operated in terms of how their coaching works, in terms of how they select players. And I just it seems to be an interesting transformation is happening, and I wonder if you have done any research in that.
Well, I follow some of the youth programs in Chicago. And I think they, by themselves deserve a complete a separate study, because, what's going on there is like so unique and so interesting to see how the youth negotiates and participates in these transgenerational rituals, and to see how they produce different outcomes. I actually have not written anything on youth programs. I mentioned a little bit about the youth program in Chicago when I studied the example of the Jimaroa Club. But I agree with you. The generational processes that are taking place in youth programs are very interesting and should be studied. On their own merit.
Yeah, thank you. I just think it's fascinating that both the Mexican League and the more traditional league are being influenced by the exchanges, and I think in a positive way. So it's encouraging, is what I'm saying.
No, absolutely. I can tell you, for instance, that in the women's Mexican national team, some of the players are born in the United States, right? And now you see this sort of a production of a new sort of a type of generational players that could play for either Mexico or the United States, because they are of Mexican descent being born in the United States, right? Hercules Gomez, that plays for the U.S., is such a case, and the same for there are two other players that have similar development, right? That they could choose, to play for Mexico or for the United States, because in theory they legally could play for any of the two.
Right? Really, like Hercules Gomez is another example.
I'm sorry, this is David Kais in San Diego. I just wanted to jump in because actually that's exactly my research. So I've been looking. I'm a PhD student in anthropology, and I'm studying essentially the integration of young, mostly Mexican American kids here in Southern California into elite youth soccer. I don't know, exactly where to start in terms of it, because obviously it's something I've been thinking a lot about. But here in Southern California, it sounds like a pretty similar situation to what you've seen in Utah, where there is starting to be a lot of integration. And, I think the history of youth soccer in the U.S. is such that it started out a lot, moving into wealthy suburban areas that didn't have many Latinos. But as years have gone by and a lot of the youth clubs have realized that in many cases some of the best players are to be found in the Latino community, they really are integrating. And there are a number of issues there in terms of giving scholarships and where does that money come from, and then resentment on that. So I don't want to hijack the conversation, but I thought I'd just add a little bit, and I'd definitely be happy to talk with other people on in other off of this call about more about that.
Great, thank you. Would anyone else like to ask a question?
I think Chris and then Melissa wanted to ask a question. So Chris, why don't you go ahead?
Yeah, hello everybody. Hello Javier, thanks very much for a fascinating paper. I was fortunate enough to watch Mexico and South Africa on three occasions, and recently during the Olympics I watched the Mexican side on four occasions. And the way you described the Mexican fans in the United States was exactly the way I observed Mexican fans in South Africa and the United Kingdom. What I thought was striking was the way South Africans and the way I assume British fans represented
Mexicanness themselves. So in other words, wearing sombreros, wearing ponchos, and putting on these moustaches, these stick-on moustaches, and were quite shocked at the number of Mexicans wearing the mask. Didn't quite necessarily understand the masks. But what my question to you is, I live in London, and the South African national team has played on a number of occasions in London. So has the Ghanaian national team, so has the Nigerian national team, and indeed
the Australian national team. I wonder if there are not comparisons that can be drawn with these teams, and also possibly Brazil, when Brazil plays in the United States, with large expat communities in these various cities, who then have a longing for whether it's a South Africanness, an Australianness, or a Mexicanness abroad, and whether one can't look at parallels beyond Mexico and Mexican fandom.
I totally agree with you. I completely agree with you. I think this is one of the venues in which we really need to do a additional research. We need to compare, you know, this type of global fan communities with the pairs, right? Like you said, you know, South Africans in London, or Brazilians in Miami, or Colombians in Miami, right? Or Central Americans in California. I think we would find a lot of similarities, and I think a study like that would really shed a light on the ways in which global communities are configuring themselves in the world of in the world of sports. I wonder if I can ask you something. If you get a sense when you saw Mexico in the Olympic Games, you get a sense of how many of these fans were coming from Mexico and how many of these fans were coming from the United States.
The overwhelming majority of Mexican fans during the Olympic Games, and indeed during the World Cup in South Africa, were from the United States. The ones that I chatted to, and that's obviously not representative in any way, but the people that I chatted to, all of them were from the United States, based in the United States.
Yeah, because that's what I thought, you know, would be there. I mean, I didn't go to the World Cup, because I don't have Peter's money, but that was my assumption. That's what I thought, that many of these
your
fans...
tax money, aren't you?
That many of these fans, you know, would come from the United States, because that's where the new Mexican middle class mm-hmm. is located.
Indeed.
Thank you.
Super, thank you.
Melissa Forbes, next question. I finally got to figure out how I could read the chat messages on this.
Hi. Thank you so much for this paper. It was really interesting in the comments that questions everyone's already asked. First, I was in Mexico City when they won the Olympics, and I can actually say I thought there was a lot of enthusiasm. I went down to the Ángel de Independencia, and I think there was, I don't know what the paper said, but there was. And I was also at some of the games in Reliance Stadium, which is sort of what takes me to my question. Coming from living in Texas for a long time, and then your paper has me thinking about so being Mexican and being United Statesian, and how these express themselves in different ways at different moments. So I'm wondering, and I'm an anthropologist, so maybe this is where this is coming from, sort of which Mexicans and when, and do you see regional differences? So for example, for me, with the going to games of the Houston Dynamo, and in other places, when I've seen teams like Chivas play U.S. teams, most of the Mexicans have been supporting Chivas. But in Houston, it wasn't necessarily the case. It was a lot more mixed. Because of the fans who are Dynamo fans weren't identifying with Mexican clubs any longer, but would identify with Mexico in a national team game, but some of their children wouldn't. So I'm wondering if you're seeing both regional differences and then generational shifts?
No, actually I have seen like a lot of diversity within these communities in terms of who they side with, right? Because, you know, ultimately being a sport fan, like nobody really tells you, you know, who to cheer for, right? So I've seen families that go for, you know, they cheer for the United States no matter what, even if their parents are from Mexico. And I've seen cases in which a third, fourth generation Mexicans cheer for the Mexican national team regardless of how they are inserted in American society. One example I can think of is the New York Jets quarterback, Mark Sanchez, right? He went to the University of Southern California, and then he made it to the NFL, and he's one of the most rabid tricolor fans. I mean, he's always cheering for the Mexican national team, and when you hear him talking, speaking about that, you get the idea that he's talking about the United States, but no, he's talking about the Mexican national team. He's basically in love with the Mexican national team. Of course, you know, his father is from Mexico, he's Chicano, he's from Southern California, and he's into that sort of a genealogy of alliances, loyalties to the Mexican national team. But you can find exactly the opposite manifestation in families that have similar socioeconomic background and similar trajectories in the United States. That's why it's so interesting to see people that can play for either Mexico or the United States who they finally decide to play for, right? You have in the Mexican national team in the women's category, many of the players being born in the U.S., and you have similar cases for I think there is one or two Mexican players that were born there. There is one at least that was born in Sacramento, California, is now playing for the Mexican national team. I cannot remember his name right now.
We have two new arrivals here in East Lansing while the questions were coming in. We have Alejandro Gonzalez who's joined us, and also Ed Murphy. Alejandro has a question, so we'll turn to him, and then we'll come back to the Skype crew. And please speak up, because the mic is kind of far away from you, Ale. Thank you.
Again, thank you for the paper and the manager. I mean, I'm also doing some research about Mexico, so it's good to have, you know, more information. And one of the things that I'm dealing mostly in my case is with media. And I was wondering, because you were mentioning about, you know, how the new stadium was built and how, you know, the global media started to build up from the 70s on. And I was wondering if you have any more information that you could share with us. I mean, how we have come into this moment in which we have basically the Mexican national team bringing a lot of money and, you know, putting a lot of effort into outreaching for these communities here in Mexico, and maybe even other places. So I was wondering if you know more of these efforts, you know, from Televisa, Univision.
I mean, one of the things that we need to provide more information in detail is the history of Televisa in the United States, right? And then the history of Televisa and Univision. And that would explain a lot of how the Mexican national team become subject of a telecast in the U.S., right? Because in the 1980s, Univision is trying to become economically viable by using Televisa's format that is soap operas and football, period, right? And in the 1980s, they're going to succeed to the point in which they're going to make not good money, but a lot of money just by broadcasting soccer and soap operas. And another development that needs to be taken into account here is the history of marketing strategies by big corporations towards the what they call the Hispanic market, right? In the 1980s, there are some serious studies that really discover or put the finger on the economic potential of the Hispanic household in terms of advertising, sponsoring, and marketing, right? In the 1980s, you have that crucial moment in which main corporations from the U.S. are going to put their money in advertising for the Hispanic market. It could be phone companies, could be whatever, right? But they are going to go in that direction, and that happens in the 1980s. They discovered that. But they discovered it because they didn't know about it. But you know, the Mexican nationals are in the 1970s the largest immigrant group in the United States, right? And we're talking about millions, right? In a nation of immigrants, Mexicans are the largest foreign group in the United States. Period. So in the 1980s, you have a very deliberate effort by marketing companies and then big corporations to go after the money and the market of the what they call the Hispanic household, right? And that's one of the keys of these developments, right? Because soccer can be seen only if somebody pays, if somebody sponsors, and that sponsorship came initially for these corporations, and now it comes from the same corporations that sponsor a professional events at the sports level in the United States. That is the beer companies, right? Beer companies, insurance companies, telecommunications, those are the sponsors of the Mexican national team in the United States, right? Budweiser sponsors the Mexican national team in the United States. AT&T sponsors the Mexican national team in the United States, right? Because they are sponsors of what they call in sports history, the big time sports, right? That's where the money is. That's where the marketing is. They have to go for it, right?
Excellent. We have three questions lined up here. One from Andrew Guest, followed by Alex Galarza, and then David Kais. So we go from the Pacific Northwest to the southern cone of South America and back up to Southern California.
Hey, thanks. I really enjoyed the paper also. It's not an area of expertise, but made me think about a bunch of things. One of the things that I found particularly thought-provoking was the idea that some of the Mexican-American fandom for the national team is a bit of a form of resistance. It felt like at points the paper was arguing that because of harsh immigration laws, because of sort of some injustices in the political system, that actually enhances the motivation to become a fan of the national team. And I was curious, sort of two things related to that. One, would the argument then be that if the laws were more just in relation to immigration, that the Mexican national team fandom would go down and that it would sort of, that they would shift towards fandom of the U.S. national team? And that seems a little implausible to me, but I'd be curious if that would be the argument. And then the other question is whether there's a way in which that's potentially kind of counterproductive. It reminds me a little bit of the controversies a few years back in the immigration reform protests, where a lot of the marchers were waving Mexican flags in the U.S. And while that may have been a valid kind of identity claim, it also provoked a lot of backlash. There was a lot of sense of like, wait a minute, from certain segments of society that wait a minute, you know, they want fair immigration laws in the U.S. and they want to have the rights of everybody, but they're identifying with the Mexican nation. And it just not that I necessarily agreed with those critiques, but it was part of the debate. And I'm sort of curious if you see a relationship there. And I'll mute myself.
Yeah, in the second part of your question, I totally agree with you. I actually have described the backlash that has already happened, right? Because people in the media have already raised, you know, concerns and protested against these Mexican loyalties in U.S. territory. And that's not only people in the media, but even American soccer players, right? Alexi Lalas went to
went on record criticizing the behavior of the Mexican fans in California because they were not supporting, you know, the U.S. and they made the American players feel like they were not playing at their home, right? So this sort of backlash has already happened and has had no impact whatsoever on the behavior of the Mexican fans, nor on the decision by the owners of these global sports facilities to house the Mexican team. That is, the owners of the stadiums in either Dallas or Houston or in New York have not really given any consideration to this backlash. And this backlash is so strong that has already happened in the world of boxing, right? In the world of boxing, also people have criticized the national loyalties of boxers of Mexican descent born in the United States and the loyalties of the fans. But of course, you know, boxing capitalizes on ethnic affiliations and national identifications, and that is not going to have any type of impact. Actually, I have described one incident in which Larry Merchant, one of the boxing authorities with HBO Now, criticized Oscar De La Hoya for, when he was a boxer, for displaying loyalty to the Mexican flag and bringing mariachi music to his fight, right? And he was like, why is he doing that? Isn't he American? He was born here. He got the gold medal, you know, in the Barcelona Games. What is his problem? And what happened at the end is that Larry Merchant had to apologize, right? Not Oscar De La Hoya, because of course, what is the biggest, you know, fan base behind boxing right now? And is the Mexican, or this sort of a global Mexican fan base. They are the majority in the world of boxing right now, and either HBO or Showcase, that are the two major networks dealing with boxing now, are not going to go in that particular direction. In terms of the first element of your question about the resistance, I think everything has to do with how the Mexican team became a main feature in sports events in the U.S. And as I explained in the paper, they became the main feature in the big-time sports in the U.S. by playing consistently against the United States. I mean, those are like the games that are going to bring fans to the arena. And those are that's the rivalry that this development has capitalized on, or created, if you will, right? This rivalry between Mexico and the United States that has had very dramatic moments in the history of the two national teams is basically what supports what's originally the backbone of this development. And people in the 1970s and 80s went to support the Mexican team because they wanted to see, just like right now, they want to see the Mexican team defeating the United States, and it has a very symbolic and a very strong cultural element, right? Because it's 11 versus 11, and they want to see the Mexican team defeating the United States in the United States territory, because that makes a big statement in terms of when the playing is level, when everything is fair, when we have the same chances, who is who, right? And that's I don't think that is going to change anytime soon, right? And of course, you know, the U.S. soccer authorities have not shy away from that rivalry, and they play Mexico also every time, anytime they have a chance or an opportunity.
Okay, I'm trying to Skype somebody in, but it's not working terribly well, so I apologize for stepping away for a moment. Alex, I think you have the next question from Buenos Aires.
Sure. I was reading your statistics on the friendly matches that were played on American soil. My question was also one about tensions, some of which you were already talking about, but you might be able to take in a slightly different direction. And that's, you say that the friendly matches played on American soil practically doubled the games played in Mexico for the same category. And I have to ask, with especially all the infrastructures that were built for hosting two World Cups, the Estadio Azteca, is there not ever, whether in the media, I suspect it would be tamped down because Televisa's interests are squarely in having more friendlies on American soil, from what I'm picking up on reading in your article, but are there not public backlashes against friendlies being played on Mexican soil? And that's a follow-up question to that is that I know the last last Continental Cup that was held in South America, only one match was held in Buenos Aires for Argentina's hosting of it, with the intent behind that being spreading sort of the grassroots growth of infrastructure for supporting a national team in stadiums being outside of the capital. So it strikes me in what I'm familiar with, I don't have a parallel in a large displaced Argentine community demanding friendlies being played in that away from home, or there being a market for friendlies to be played away from home. But it surprises me that there wouldn't be backlashes against such a large amount of friendlies being played outside of Mexican soil. So is there a breakdown between who is watching these games on Mexican soil, as maybe Melissa was talking about? There is maybe a generational divide that is bringing those two brands that you were talking about together, one brand for Mexico, one brand for Mexicans in the United States. And does it have any correlation with other sports that are followed in Mexico? Because we know soccer isn't nearly as hegemonic in Mexico as it might be in other Latin American countries. And also, just one kind of slight follow-up on that, does it have anything to do with a backlash against commercialization of sport in general? I remember thinking back to Roger Magazine's ethnography of Pumas fans, it seems like the anti-patronage, anti-commercialization around soccer as a consumable activity is such a central identity of Pumas fans that it would surprise me that there's not an active discourse, critics are criticizing the money that's being made by having so many games on American soil, even if it is showing the Yankees what's up,
No, I think that's an excellent point. I think you're absolutely right. I think people, the media in Mexico is not entirely happy with what's going on with the Mexican team in the U.S. and the Mexican fans in Mexico are not happy at all, because now Mexico plays more games in the U.S. than in Mexico itself. And it was very interesting to see some of the qualifying games with Mexico in the just recent weeks, when you see the Mexican national team completely unable to bring not a sold-out crowd to the Aztec Stadium in Mexico City against the United States, but not even a sold-out crowd in the qualifiers. That is, if you see the Mexican national team performances in Mexico, people do not go to see them play. Right, so I think maybe I think maybe there is a process in which the Mexican soccer fans are not feeling the same type of affiliation or loyalty or association or affinity with the Mexican national team because of all these processes. But if you go, what I'd like to analyze more in detail is like the history of sold-out crowds for the Mexican national team, because I'm sure that the majority of these events happen in the United States and not in Mexico. From the qualifying games that I was able to watch, thanks to Univision, the Mexican national team was not able to bring not even half of the capacity at the Aztec Stadium. So the stadium is half empty, and now you have the Mexican soccer authorities discussing the possibility of having the Mexican national team playing in other places, not in the U.S., but in Mexico, places other than Mexico City, because soccer fans in Mexico City are not following the tricolor the way it was or the way it used to be in the previous qualifiers. So I don't know if this is because there is a saturation of soccer in the market or because fans are feeling not as connected to the Mexican national team in general. I don't have the answer for that process, but you're absolutely right. That process is already in progress in Mexico. Now, if you see how things are developing in other sports, like the history of boxing is very illustrative because Mexican boxing became a full-fledged, you know, a capitalist sport before soccer in Mexico. And if you see how boxing has evolved, now all the boxing matches with Mexican fighters take place in the United States. They don't take place in Mexico. I mean, Mexico is no longer the house of the boxing Mexican industry. They all take place in the United States, but that's a process that started again in the 1960s and 70s with people, Mexican boxers, that went to California and decided to make their careers there. Like this guy, for instance, Rubén Olivares, he was the first Mexican boxing international champion that was not a Mexican national champion. He sort of became a professional boxer in California and not in the United States. So we could speculate and we could say, you know, maybe a similar development is going to take place now with soccer, because either way, you know, the money in soccer is now on TV and cable is not really at the gate. So who knows?
Thank you. We have Corey Cropper signing off. Has to go and teach. So thanks for joining us, Corey.
Thank you. Nos vemos.
Thank you.
Adios. Okay. David Kais, I think you were up next.
Yeah, thanks. And thanks. I really enjoyed the paper, especially as it is something that's very similar to what I do. And I guess my main question in reading it, I'm just curious to hear you talk a little bit more about the actual research process and specifically the evidence that you're using in making your arguments. I'm thinking specifically of, probably the most vivid example is the use of lucha libre masks and that kind of thing. And the debate, you know, about whether they are, that's an act of resistance or something else. I guess for me, I buy your argument. It makes sense to me. I'm curious, though, if you could maybe talk a little bit more about the evidence used and if you thought ever about, you know, making that more upfront, say, in your paper, because I feel like it's convincing to those of us maybe who are really immersed in this, but I wonder what the reaction might be for someone who's not as immersed in this world.
No, you're totally right. I should have included some of the testimonies and the interviews. The problem is that I was in China and then I came back, you know, to the U.S. and then I just didn't have enough time to do the full transcriptions. But in terms of the methodology, you know, what I do basically is that I am a trained photographer, so I go to the stadiums, I take pictures, and then people that I think might be willing to talk to me in camera, you know, I just do oral histories on the spot, right? I just interview them on the spot and where are you coming from, why are you coming here, and what do you think of the whole thing, and what do you think of the Mexican national team playing here, and then at the end of the interview, you know, it's like, why are you wearing, you know, what you're wearing, right? Because, I mean, what is it that that you would like to other people to think of you? That type of thing. So I do oral histories with fans, right? And I use I have recorded interviews and you're completely right. You're totally right. I should have incorporated some of the testimonies so that it could be more evident, you know, the connection between the masks and the idea of wrestling and the idea of being a protagonist of a hero in the stage.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Would any of the folks who are on the call who haven't gotten a chance to speak interested in asking a question? I'm thinking of Anna Paula or David Kilpatrick or Sean Jacobs.
I mean, I could ask a question. I missed the bulk of the first 30 minutes, so what I'm going to ask might have been answered. But the curious thing that I wondered about was not so much the reaction of the Mexican public to all of this, but I kind of was wondering about how this all gets reported, let's say, in the Dallas media, you know, like the Dallas television. So if it's clear that when the stadium gets opened, it's the Mexican national team that inaugurates, you know, the home of the Dallas Cowboys, or that breaks attendance records there, I was curious, like, how that gets reported. Not generally, because I want to add something to this. So how the local TV reports that, like, you know, what's the tone of it? What's the reaction to it? I mean, is it played up? Is it celebrated? Because there is part of why I'm asking this, and I'm trying to remember if this is in the paper, but you now have Rupert Murdoch, who runs channels that generally provides a space where anti-immigrant or also kind of very sort of anti-Mexican rhetoric, you know, one language and all that other kind of discourses circulate, starting a new channel. I forgot what it's called, Fox Mundos or whatever. Like, so he's clearly, you know, it's about the pragmatism of that kind of politics and its reaction to what American identity is. But in this instance, of course, it's the Mexican national team that enters the conversation. I'm just curious, like, what's the reaction of the kind of mainstream media in those cities where the Mexican national team played, created a spectacle, and everybody made money?
Mm-hmm. Well, in terms of its coverage by mainstream media, I would say that, like, local media, well, it depends how you define mainstream media. Because if you define mainstream media by ratings, then the mainstream media would be the Spanish language media, right? And the Spanish language media really celebrates all these events, right? And the Spanish language media really gives a lot of coverage. Like the example with the gold medal in the Olympic Games, right? The Spanish media was covering that as it was like the world championship, right? They would cover, they would replay the match, they would interview fans, they would interview players, they would interview anybody, right? Those are what the ratings are. Now, how the mainstream media in English reports that event, right? Basically, it's a minor note, right? Basically, it's not an event, it's a non-event, right? It doesn't merit any type of significant attention, which tells you why the media in Spanish language is so popular, right? Because in the other media, there is a process of basically invisibility for this type of events. Now, how the sports media reports on these events, like ESPN gives a lot of attention to the Mexican national team performances because ESPN is trying to get a share in the pie, right? ESPN is trying to really participate in the Hispanic market, and they could be like, now that they have ESPN Deportes, they could be really, really happy if they could benefit or have a share in this type of events. In the sports media world, it receives a wide coverage, right? But in the English language media, it's invisible. In the Spanish language media, it's the center. It's the centerpiece, basically.
Right. Let me just follow up. So part of my thing, which I probably didn't articulate very well, is like, how would something? Because I just googled while you were talking. The channel I'm talking about is called Mundo Fox.
Uh-huh.
Murdoch is
right.
I'm just wondering, like, how that. I think it's a bilingual channel, how that might change this, you know, this kind of conversation.
Yeah, I mean, probably, I mean, now every single major network and media conglomerate wants to have a Spanish language, you know, a platform, right? Because of the spectacular developments in Univision and the Soccer Plus soap operas format, right? Now everybody wants to have a, Asher. So you're right. I mean, there is no way to anticipate what are going to be like the next developments in this in these events.
Just to interject here briefly, Ana Paula Martinez sent a message saying she doesn't have a mic or a question, but wanted to thank us for such an interesting discussion. As a Mexican Tri fan, I'm quoting here, living in the United States, whose sister does advertising for Univision, I felt like you've been reading my mind for this past hour, which is quite a brilliant comment. Thank you, Ana. David Kilpatrick. Are you there, David? No, we can't. Okay, we'll wait for you. As soon as the connection is up, we'll turn it over to you. Melissa is also typing there. In the meantime, while this is panning out, I have a kind of silly question to throw in there. It's about the Disney trilogy Go, which regrettably is one of my daughter's favorite movies. What do you think of that? I mean, they want, you know, they reenacted Santiago Muñoz's career I don't know how many times. What do you think of these movies, especially in regards to this very important part of your paper, which has to do with the negative images of Mexicans and the stereotypes and the way in which people construct and perform their own identity? Have these movies constructed particular images of Mexican immigrants and the relationship to football that are different from before? Have you seen the movies? What do you think of them?
I haven't seen that movie.
There's three.
Yeah, there's three. Or
yeah.
Any of the three.
He starts in Southern California, ends up in Newcastle, goes to Real Madrid, and I haven't seen the third, but I heard he went to Argentina.
Uh-huh.
So.
After Real Madrid, so he goes to Castle,
yeah, and the second one, you know, he's hanging out with Zidane and Beckham, Raul. I mean, they're actual cameos of all of these guys.
I can't say it, but I mean, you know, in Latin America, the history of sports and film is pretty fascinating, right? Actually, I show in my class last Monday segments of Pelota de Trapo. This movie from 1948, Argentina, in which the protagonist grows up in a potrero, right? He's the pibe from the potrero, and his dream is like the tango dream, right? The sueño del pibe is to, you know, to become a professional player, to play in the Argentinian league, and then to win a championship with the Argentina national team, which he does when they defeat Brazil in Cameron, right? With real players and all that, so that, you know, that sort of conducts to riches, you know, format when applied to Latin American sports it's an old recipe, right? And it's it deserves a separate study, right? Because they are, you know, common trends, but they're also the transformations. I mean, it's interesting that you say that this guy is from California, right?
Well, it's a Mexican immigrant family in Southern California. He works with his father, who runs a gardening business, if I'm not mistaken, which is totally fitting the images you talk about in the paper. You know? And then he plays in the amateur leagues. He gets scouted by a former Newcastle player, I think of Irish background, if I'm not mistaken. So there's a kind of interesting twist there. And then he brings him to Newcastle, and he makes it. And then, of course, the second film, he goes to Real Madrid, you know, Champions League and all of that. And I haven't seen the third one because I was cringing so badly at the end of the second.
My problem is that...
But the kids loved it.
Yeah, my problem is that I saw the documentary film by Pisturica about Maradona, and I really like it. I like it a lot. It's my favorite. And then I saw Pelé's film, you know, Pelé o Eterno, and I just couldn't take it. And after that, I sort of got sick. Soccer movies, right? Because they're all like Leo Eterno. So I decided to take a break from soccer films.
Well, we've had a film session that was quite successful earlier in the year, and we're going to have another one later. So hopefully you can join us.
Absolutely.
For that. Okay, Chris Boltzmann has left. So we have a question from David. Is your microphone working?
Is it working? Can you hear me now?
Yes.
All right, good deal. thanks very much. I'm very sorry to come in so late, so I apologize if my question is something that's already been covered, but the work of yours that I've read, you focus very much on L3 and the whole national identity that's played out with the fan base here. But so if someone's already asked this, I apologize for my late arrival, but I'm very curious about how you trace out or what you think about Mexican identity in relation to Major League Soccer. In particular, Chivas USA and that whole branding situation and what Chivas represents in terms of Mexican identity in Guadalajara and how that translates or doesn't translate to Los Angeles. And also, a related matter, the Houston Dynamo and their original, when they moved from San Jose, they were to be called Houston 1836, but there was an objection from the Mexican-American community to that, so they adopted the Dynamo identity instead. So I wondered if you had any thoughts on that.
Yeah, the Chivas USA, I mean, it's pretty interesting, you know, how corporate America is trying to capitalize on the expansion of fans of Mexican and Latin American descent. But I should say that, you know, this type of efforts is not anything new. I mean, you have the example of the Los Angeles Aztecs, right, that recruited Hugo Sanchez and other, Leonardo Cuellar, other players from Mexico, and that we're trying to capitalize in this sort of Mexicanness crafted from the top-down, you know, a corporate structure of MLS. I think the problem with the MLS is not how they are trying to pack the product. I think the problem with them is the product, is that they don't want to pay talented players. And for as long as they don't pay the same type of money like the Mexican league or any other leagues in the area, they're going to struggle with the fan base, because Mexican fans of the national team in the U.S. are soccer fans. They are soccer fans, right? They are fans of Mexico, too, but they are soccer fans, and they're not going to settle for a product that is not of the quality that they expect. I mean, period. The MLS, you know, the quality of the games is not anywhere near the quality of other leagues, and that has been the problem of the MLS for years and years. It's like the owners don't want to pay, you know, talented players at the competitive salaries, and therefore they're going to get a product that it doesn't matter how you package. You can package it as, you know, the Mexican or the Super Mexican or the Mexican Masked Man or whatever you want to call it. It is not going to fly if they don't have competitive product that can really express or manifest the social aspirations of this fan base as a successful story, right? And one of the things that I discovered when I was doing field work in Chicago with the people I was interviewing is that when we practice together and when I play with them, they would treat me well if they thought I would contribute to the team. But if I was not of no good for the team, then, you know, they didn't care about anything. And therefore, you know, we have to remember that this is a sports association. Those are sports communities, and they know and they appreciate the quality of soccer, because these people, for the most part, are soccer players, former soccer players, and they have been with soccer, you know, their entire lives, and they can really appreciate and know what type of game they are being offered. Right, and because of that, for the MLS, is extremely difficult to. They complain about many things, but they never, you know, they never indicate what really is going wrong with them in terms of the quality of the product. And likewise, if the Mexican national team comes to the U.S. and starts losing games and games and games, fans are going to stop going to the stadium, because nobody wants to see somebody that loses on regular, permanent basis.
Well, to follow up on that, as a New York Red Bulls fan, I think it's been a big disappointment for at least the franchise that Rafa Marquez hasn't been able to bring out a larger audience of a Mexican fan base for the Red Bulls. And they've certainly invested in talent to try to raise the quality of the club. But the presence of someone like Marquez is not translated, right? So they'll go see Marquez if he's with L3 at MetLife Stadium, and they'll show up with 70,000 people. But when it's a Wednesday night and Marquez is wearing the captain's armband, there's not the interest there. So I guess my question is also a matter of national allegiance and then club allegiance. Maybe there was an assumption on the part of some people at MLS that the Chivas identity as a Mexican identity would draw people in, but then maybe it's turned people off. Obviously, thrilled when he got FIFA 13 yesterday to be able to play with Jorge Campos in the World 11 team. It was really the first Mexican star to play in MLS, but.
Yeah, well, I mean, that is a great example because, you have Rafael Márquez coming to play for New York, but any decent, soccer fan that knows the Mexican league knows that Rafael Márquez shouldn't be playing for the New York Bulls or for anybody, right? Because he had been in the bench in the Barcelona for years and years, and basically he didn't have a lot left. And that's exactly what happened with the Chicago Fire when they brought Cuauhtémoc Blanco. I mean, Cuauhtémoc Blanco is a great player, right? But not now. Now he's a former player. Now, he shouldn't be playing, period. And Mexican fans identify that type of elements in the recruitment efforts of the MLS. I mean, if they brought Rafael Márquez to New York and he didn't work out, it's because Rafael Márquez had basically depleted his physical resources. But I can tell you, if they could bring, for instance, Giovanni Dos Santos, right? Or Marco Fabian, the results would be entirely different because a lot of people would like to see these players that are coming of age, that are in the process of really making a contribution, playing in the United States. But that has not been the case. The MLS is bringing, they brought the, who was this guy? Thierry Henry, right? How old is he?
31, I think.
31?
No.
I thought he was 31.
But 31? But with a lot of mileage in the European League, right? So anyways, I mean, that was my point. I don't know if I'm right or wrong because I have not, workshopped this type of developments, but that's my opinion.
He's listed as being 35.
What?
He's listed on Wikipedia as being 35.
Well, I don't think anyone here is going to argue that the MLS is a top-tier league, but maybe in 10 years we'll be having a different kind of conversation. But certainly you have to pay better money. I remember seeing the rankings of the professional leagues around the world, and all the bottom teams in terms of salary were MLS teams. The last one was Columbus Crew, if I'm not mistaken. Average salary for a professional player. You're going to attract Federico Higuain, but you're not going to attract Gonzalo Higuain with that kind of money.
So basically your point then would be that in relation to MLS, you feel that more astute marketing is needed because the Mexican-American fan base is really just shouldn't be taken for granted in that
way? Absolutely.
Thank you.
Okay, I think at this point we are in added time, to use football terminology. So maybe it's a good moment to ask if anyone has any final points, comments, or questions to ask before we wrap it up.
I have a quick question.
This is Ed Murphy in East Lansing.
Maybe this was already asked, and I too came late. So I was in this piece, the global football piece. You do spend a lot of time talking about the leagues that developed here in the States, and especially the one, and you just alluded to the fact that you've done field work in Chicago. I'm curious a little bit about the lack of the way in which those. One thing that strikes me about this paper, and is just how interrelated this story is, about how much the Mexican national team depends on sort of the U.S. market and all these things that are happening in the United States. And yet, there's also, for a variety of reasons, very little integration between American soccer players and Mexican soccer players. And one of the things, I mean, I grew up in suburban Chicago, played in all kinds of leagues from the time I was 6 years old. All the sorts of feeder systems onto the state level and then onto the national level were always with the suburban, mostly white, white suburban teams that then would feed into that. And then there was, we would go into Chicago every once in a while and play some of the Mexican teams, but they were really sort of shunted aside when it came to integrating them into any kind of process that would get them, into the U.S. national team system. There are a few players now that seem to be have to go through a decision as to whether or not they're going to play in Mexico or in the United States. But I was just wondering if you could comment a little bit on kind of, this really big separation between what seem to be two very different systems and then the lack of integration. And if this story about the Mexican national team and this really intense fan base for Mexico and seeing themselves, in this sort of very reinstantiation of a very big kind of ethnic difference through the teams, if that plays any role in the way in which I think the U.S. national team overall has done a very poor job of integrating Mexican players into its overall system.
The U.S. national team now has three or four big plays of Mexicans, and we have it as long as they have the Lima Gomez, and the who is the other guy? The guy who's called Orozco. The guy who's scoring against Mexico in the Aztec Stadium. It's changing. The future of the U.S. soccer is with these leagues that I've been working on, because those are the leagues that have like massive numbers. And what you were mentioning is very important, that the day in which the amateur leagues, the mainstream amateur leagues and the Mexican leagues are integrated, that day is going to change everything, right? That moment is going to change everything in terms of loyalties, allegiances, and who plays for who and who cheers for. But that day has not arrived. You still see in Chicago, this is one of the most sort of integrated cities. You see in Chicago very, very, very different paths for Latin American athletes and mainstream athletes, right? And that's what really is at the root of this process. That we have Mexican communities that are separated, they're isolated, and that's the problem. That is the problem. But the day, the moment in which there is an integration between the amateur leagues in the U.S. and the Mexican leagues in these urban areas, that is going to change a lot, because now Mexicans are going to have the opportunity to contribute, in the big time, market. That you have to do what people are calling the entertainment industry, the crossover, right? Right now there is not, there are not a lot of channels for this type of crossover, right? So That's what explains, this sort of a very sort of valid, loyalty to the Mexican national team that was built on the rival league with the United States, right? This is Mexico versus the United States, and that's it.
And there's a little bit of an irony there in that, many of the buyers or business interests that you're talking about, they also sort of feed off the separation here, right?
Okay, the last question goes to Anna, who says, do you think these fan attitudes might encourage a joint U.S.-Mexico 2026 FIFA World Cup bid instead of an individual Mexican bid? This is like the NAFTA bid.
2026 NAFTA, right? So, I would say if Qatar can organize the World Cup, right, who cannot?
We'll have to see if they can organize it. They've won the bid.
Yeah. And in terms of bid, I don't know. It's like Qatar doesn't have, stadiums, they don't have clubs, they don't have anything, but they got it, so why not NAFTA, right?
And then we'll bring our Canadian cousins into the picture too, perhaps, and save them from further marginalization. Okay, well, at this point, I think everyone joins me in thanking Javier
Pescador for a wonderful paper and brilliant discussion. thank you to David Kais, Andrew Guest, Anna Paula, David Kilpatrick, Alex Galarza, Sean Jacobs, and the others who joined us online. And we are going to have another session in late October or early November. Look for the email. It's going to be on soccer and philosophy, right? Please check your email and participate next time. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.